Hi, I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen.
Welcome to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. On today's show, when the days grow shorter, many animals hibernate. As much as we humans may want to do the same, that's not a very practical option. But if you suffer from fatigue, lethargy, weight gain, and depression during the winter months, you may have SAD, seasonal affective disorder. We'll talk to a psychology professor about the latest treatments.
But first, knowing how to recognize and respond to the symptoms of a stroke can mean the difference between life and death, literally. Research suggests that individuals treated within 90 minutes of having a stroke have better survival and recovery rates than those treated outside that critical window of care. Stroke symptoms are recognizable in most cases if you know what to look for.
Here to provide the basics on what happens during a stroke, as well as diagnosis and treatment, is Dr. Larry Goldstein, professor of neurology at Duke University and director of the Duke Comprehensive Stroke Center in North Carolina. Welcome to Take Care, Dr. Goldstein. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today.
I'd like to start with the basics, if you would. Describe what takes place in the body when a person is having a stroke.
Well, the first thing to think about is that stroke is not one disease or one process. As we think about it, there are two major types. There's what we call an ischemic stroke, and that's when a blood vessel to or within the brain is closed off. And what it does is starve that portion of the brain of blood and oxygen, so the brain cells then die. The second major type of stroke is what we call hemorrhagic stroke, and that can occur in two main different types. One is when there's bleeding within the brain itself, and then the second type is when there's bleeding around the outside of the brain. That type is caused most commonly by a broken aneurysm, an outpouching of a brain artery that then leaks around the brain.
So when we ask the question, what causes a stroke, and you've described two of the more common ones, I should say, do they each have a different cause, or is it mostly the same thing with a different reaction in the body?
No, there are a whole variety of different causes. Of the two major types, the bleeding type and the ischemic type, about 80% are the ischemic type. So that's by far and away the most common. They may share some risk factors, for example, high blood pressure, cigarette smoking. Excess alcohol consumption can increase the risk of both types of stroke, but they are actually quite distinct. And within each one of those main categories, there are many, many, many different causes.
So why don't we talk about the ischemic stroke just because it is the more common? I think that would help us understand when we move forward because we want to understand what's happening in the body at that time and why seeking immediate medical care is so critical in managing that stroke.
For the ischemic stroke, this is the type when a blood vessel is closed off. What we know from both experimental studies in laboratory animals as well as from a wealth of clinical data is that the longer the brain goes without blood and oxygen, the more likely the damage is to be irreversible. So one of the major treatments, and actually the only treatment for acute ischemic stroke that's approved by the FDA, is the clot-busting drug, TPA, tissue plasminogen activator. Now, we can treat out to 4.5 hours based on national guidelines. We can treat based on FDA indications up to 3 hours. But within that entire period of time, the one thing that's clear is that the sooner we can treat after symptoms begin, the greater the likelihood that the patient is going to benefit. And the main benefit from these interventions is improvements in functional outcome measured out at 3 months. So with these types of treatments in the appropriate patient, the likelihood of having no disability after 3 months can be increased by almost a factor of 50%.
Dr. Goldstein, I know from personal experience my father was prone to strokes, and I did discover early on the efficacy of TPA, which is, I have to say, quite extraordinary when you consider how much a patient who's survived a stroke can regain being administered TPA. But you mentioned that it is a clot-busting drug, so I would imagine one of the critical issues is you have to determine early on, is it an ischemic stroke or is it a hemorrhagic stroke, because they would be different treatments. I'm assuming if there's open bleeding into the brain, you wouldn't want to apply a clot-busting drug, would you?
That's absolutely right. And one of the messages is that for people in general is that there's no way to be absolutely sure without a brain imaging test as to what the type of stroke is. There are features about it that may make us think that it's one type or the other, but there's no way to know for sure without an imaging study. One of the things that people think about doing is when they think somebody might be having a stroke, they equate it with a similar process as a heart attack, and they give the person aspirin. Well, aspirin affects blood clotting, and if the person was actually having a bleeding kind of stroke, it could actually make things much worse. So without being evaluated and without a brain imaging study, there is no way to be sure of the type of stroke. So when the patient gets to a hospital, there are many things that need to be done and need to be done very, very quickly because, remember, as I said before, the clock is ticking. Time saved is brain saved. So we have to first identify that the patient may be having a stroke. There are a series of physical examinations that need to be done. A series of blood tests need to be done. A brain imaging study, usually a CT scan, but sometimes a brain MRI scan needs to be done. Then it has to be determined that the patient is otherwise a candidate for these types of drugs. There are a number of important exclusion criteria that would make us not use these types of drugs. And then the patient or family has to be informed about the risks, potential benefits, and the drug has to be started. Well, doing this within the national target of 1 hour, as you can imagine, is very complicated. And you have to have systems in place to be able to respond to potential stroke patients immediately and to get all of these interventions and evaluations done.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness on WRVO Public Media. Our guest today is Dr. Larry B. Goldstein, professor of neurology at Duke University. Dr. Goldstein is also director of the Duke Comprehensive Stroke Center in North Carolina, and our topic today is stroke. Dr. Goldstein, you mentioned that critical first hour. It would seem then that a large part of that critical care falls upon the family members or people around the person who is undergoing a stroke. Because in reality, if you've never seen the symptoms, you may not understand what's going on. I know in the case of my father having a stroke, he was inside the family home. He didn't pick my mother up from work. And when she broke in to find him, he was muttering and saying things that did not make sense. And it wasn't even language. He was having problems actually articulating clear words. She called me and I knew. I said, call 911, get him into an ambulance. What are the symptoms that most people should be aware of that herald a stroke?
You're exactly right. From the national data, the most common reason that we can't use these clot-busting drugs is because patients don't get to us in time, that they wait thinking that the symptoms are going to improve. And as I said, every minute that goes by, the likelihood that treatment is going to be effective is decreasing. So in terms of recognizing symptoms, this has been a very difficult thing to communicate to the lay public because the various symptoms of stroke can be difficult to recognize. One acronym that's being popularized now is FAST, F-A-S-T, where F stands for face, so weakness or drooping on one side of the face. A stands for arm weakness, so you have the person hold their arm out and it droops on one side or they can't hold one side up. And S stands for speech, slurred speech or difficulty speaking, such as you just described with your dad. And then the last part, the T part, is time, and that's to remind people that every minute that goes by, the likelihood of benefit from treatment is going down, so they need to react immediately. The reaction should be call 911 because, again, a large amount of research data shows that patients that arrive at the hospital via 911 are evaluated much quicker than patients that drive in themselves. The problem with this FAST acronym, though, is that it doesn't cover all of the symptoms of stroke that are common. So another way to remember this is something called walk, talk, reach, see, feel, the five W's. So walk is having an abrupt onset of difficulty walking. T, talk, abrupt difficulties with speech or understanding speech. R, reach, problem with the arm is either weak or numb. S, see, That's a loss of vision in one or both eyes, problems seeing to one side. And F, feel, that's a severe, unusual headache that comes on abruptly in somebody who normally doesn't get headaches. The F part is important because that helps identify patients who may have a bleeding kind of stroke, the subarachnoid hemorrhage or the bleeding inside the brain. So we have these two things, the FAST acronym that's being used now because it's simple, it's straightforward, it does capture a lot of the common stroke symptoms, but then also the walk, talk, reach, see, feel, which covers more stroke symptoms and also covers symptoms of bleeding stroke.
Many of us may experience stroke ourselves or in our loved ones, and it seems to be an acute situation. But I'm understanding now that I saw my father go through it, there are actually possible, in some cases, precursors to a stroke. What might they be?
Well, sometimes the symptoms of stroke can be very, very temporary. They can come and go. So somebody who, for example, develops weakness in an arm that may last a few minutes and then go away, or loss of vision in one eye that may go away in a few minutes, or trouble speaking that may go away in a few minutes, all of those could be symptoms of stroke, and we call these TIAs, transient ischemic attacks. And you can tell from the name T, the transient, that means it's coming and going quickly. I, that's the diagnosis part, that these are coming from a problem with a brain blood vessel. And A, the attack part, it comes on quickly, it comes on and then tends to go away. So TIAs may be a warning sign that a stroke is imminent. Again, it's important not to ignore those symptoms because the highest risk of stroke is soon after a TIA occurs. And if we're going to be able to intervene to prevent the stroke, we need to be able to evaluate the patients very, very quickly.
Dr. Goldstein, are the symptoms different in men and women as they are with heart attacks, or is it pretty universal?
Well, there are some unusual symptoms that may be more common in women, but they're not very specific. But in general, most symptoms of stroke are quite similar between men and women. Some things, for example, unexplained fatigue may be more common in women than it is in men. But that's not a strong signal that a stroke's happened, but that's certainly been described. More confusion sometimes is reportedly more common in women than men. What we call focal symptoms, meaning that we can't figure out one particular part of the brain that's responsible for the symptoms. So those may be different, but in general, the major symptoms are actually quite similar between men and women. Those are the exceptions, not the rule.
Right. And I'd like to talk before we go about stroke prevention strategies, but first I should ask, is this hereditary/genetic? Does this run in families? And if so, what can a person do to diminish their risk of having a stroke if they know it's in the family?
Sure. So the way to think about this in general is that there are some risk factors that are inherent and we can't do anything about. So one, for example, is age. Stroke risk about doubles for every decade of age over age 55, but still about a third of strokes occur in people under age 55. We're seeing a surge of stroke in middle-aged women, for example, now, that may be coming from a variety of causes. Another risk factor that you can't do anything about is race, ethnicity. African Americans have had about double the risk of dying of stroke compared to Caucasians. And another thing, as you said, is family history. So if you have a first-degree relative, a parent, a brother, a sister, that's had a stroke under age 65, that is also associated with an increased risk. Some of the unusual causes of stroke may be directly inherited, but they tend to be unusual. There are some other genetic risk factors or genetic predisposition to stroke as well. But again, these are things that you can't do anything about. So the best policy is to focus in on lifestyle changes and things that we can do things about.
And then just tell us in general terms what someone can do, even if it's not a family history, to improve their chances of never having a stroke.
So there are several very, very important lifestyle things that everybody can do to decrease their stroke risk. One thing is to exercise for at least 30 minutes most days of the week. Walking at a brisk but comfortable pace for 20 to 30 minutes is quite helpful. diet, having a healthy diet, that's one that's low in sodium, high in potassium, 3 to 5 servings of fruits and vegetables daily, not smoking and not being exposed to environmental tobacco smoke can dramatically lower stroke risk. Having a lean body weight, the body mass index, which is a measure of height and weight of less than 25, decreases stroke risk. And also in people who do drink, for women, no more than 1 alcoholic drink a day, for men, no more than 2. What we found is that people who follow these 5 healthy lifestyle habits have an 80%, an 80% lower risk of having a first stroke compared to others who don't follow those healthy lifestyles. There are other medical interventions depending upon specific risk factors that are completely treatable. For example, high blood pressure, atrial fibrillation, or regular beating of the upper chambers of the heart. These are 2 very common risk factors that can be treated to reduce stroke risk.
Dr. Larry B. Goldstein is professor of neurology at Duke University, and he's also director of the Duke Comprehensive Stroke Center in North Carolina. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Goldstein.
Oh, thank you.
For more information on stroke and Dr. Goldstein, visit the Take Care webpage at wrvo.org/take care. If you've missed any segments or want to hear them again, podcasts of our show are available on iTunes and the WRVO website.
Coming up, it may be the winter blues or something more serious. How to recognize seasonal affective disorder and what you can do to feel better. You're listening to Take Care on WRVO Public Media.